Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, good evening, boys and girls. My name is Joshua Bradley Winter, and welcome back to the Birding Life Youth Podcast. Today's guest was a safari guide, but now he's studying veterinary. Let's hear what Nick Human has to say. So hello, Nick. Nice to have you on the podcast and not having to see you in a lecture hall. How are you doing?
Hi there. Thanks for having me. Good to be here. Good to see you outside of the benches. Doing good. It's been a good break so far. Feeling rested and ready for the next session.
That's good. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you started birding.
All right, so yeah, I worked a bit as a field guide. That's a bit of my background. I studied to be a field guide and worked at Madikwe Game Reserve, Madikwe Safari Lodge, to be specific. And in my time working there, decided I wanted to pursue a career in the veterinary field. Did the necessary things and applied, and now we're studying that. In terms of the birding, there was always an interest from a young age. My family had an interest in birds. My grandmother, especially, not really in the line of keeping lists or identification or anything like that, but just an interest in how beautiful they were and the colors and the sounds. And my granny would feed them in the garden, would put bread out for them, and then see who would come and eat on her lawn. So there was, from a young age, there was always that interest. And it probably only really turned into a more formal sense of birding when, towards the end of high school, we started to go on trips to the Kruger with family friends, and they were into their birding. And through them, we started to realize, okay, these things have names, and there's different shapes, and you can make predictions on, what the bill looks like and what the shape of the body is. You can sort of get families together, and building onto that. And suddenly there was this interest. And we would always keep lists of sort of animals that we'd seen on a game drive when we were driving around, and try and see how much diversity we could get. And now suddenly we had this new aspect. We could add birds to that and see how many birds we could see. And it started off really basic, but I think that was part of the fun. Was now, as you do it, you suddenly start to realize, okay, that one looks a little bit like that one that I know. So maybe it can be like that. And you start looking in the book and you find it, and it's pure endorphin boost when you get it right. So that was cool. And then it really, from there, it took off. It probably became more serious, or a bit more of a thing that I really, really loved when I started guiding. So going to field guide college, and it became a bit more of a formal training into it, and a bit more help in actually how to identify and how to build this sort of family catalog, and getting into a bit more depth. And then through working at Madikwe and conducting safaris, and whether it be with guests or just going out by ourselves, there was always a nice addition to add birds to it. Madikwe is a huge game reserve. And I felt that adding birds to the experience really helped to tie in the whole experience. So you don't have long gaps where there's a bit of silence, and you're not seeing too much. You can't have action all the time. But it also gives you something different, so you don't spend the whole time just, trying to find that lion, trying to find the dogs, trying to get to leopard or cheetah. You spend a bit of time at water, and there's birds everywhere. Once you have an interest in it, then you can enjoy it. And I think probably the thing that really tied birding for me, and what sort of solidified it, is that you can take birding goes with you anywhere. Being in the bush and looking for big game, and that you have to be there. But birding was a nice way to bring bring nature to wherever I was. You know, you can be on campus, you can be in traffic, you can be walking around the neighborhood, and there's birds everywhere, and you just spend a bit of time, you'll be able to pick them up. And that was always fun for me, is, you know, depending on where I am, like, okay, there's a bit of nature here, just to bring a bit of peace and a bit of calm, and you know, make it a bit more comfortable and a bit more, you know, a bit more of a comfort zone, if I can put it like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that you say that birding can be done everywhere and anywhere, because yeah, some of the best birding places are not places that you want to go to, like sewage works and
for sure
and rubbish sure. dumps. They provide some of the best birds sometimes.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. That was a big thing for me. Like when I started to realize, you know, so once I got into birding and was doing a lot in game reserves, and then came back home and suddenly realized just the diversity of species that has always been, you know, around me in suburbs. I just never noticed that. You're like, okay, these things don't just occur in what, you know, inverted commas, in the wild. You know, they're here, they're around us, they're with us. So that was really exciting for me, that you can actually look for these things wherever you are. That was a big part for me.
Yeah. And having spent so much time at Matikwe, can you tell us a little bit about the birding there? What species are there? Is it good for birding? What do you say?
So Matikwe, first of all, what a special place, right? Absolutely loved my time in Matikwe. It is, I think, probably one of the biggest hidden gems in terms of safari, in terms of outdoor spaces, in terms of birding. You know, it's probably the best kept secret. Matikwe is huge, 75,000 hectares or 750 square kilometers. And in that, you've got such a diverse landscape. You know, it changes from more mountainous or hilly areas to completely flat plains. There's the Mariko River that runs through, which gives a different aspect. Lots of little areas where there's some thicket. So you've got a whole lot of different areas, which provides a lot of different good birding. And also the fact that you're sort of in this halfway point between the Kalahari and the low fault, and where the two of them sort of meet, Matikwe is there. And so you've got a bit of species that would occur in either one, both occurring within the reserve. I loved it. Some of the more special species that were there, Kalahari scrub robin was a good one for the area, short-clawed lark, southern pied babblers and all their noise. And then, all their noise. And the sand grass, double-banded yellow-throated and birchels occurring in the reserve, which is quite nice to have the diversity with them. And as you go around, you really do get a nice and a really special overview of birds in general. I think it's a good area to get. You can get a nice wide view of birds. With the river there, you've got a lot of the kingfishers, you know, giant malachite pied, good chance of seeing them there. Hummercorps, bee eaters nesting in the banks. Finfoot, good area for finfoot, but as we know, elusive.
Very elusive.
Colleagues of mine have seen them there. People have spoken about it being a really good area for finfoot. I've never had the joys of it, but we stay positive and hopefully one day. Moving towards the plains, courses, lapwings, good areas for them. Some of the smaller things, quails. Matikwe was the first place I'd ever seen a harlequin quail and common quail. So that was quite fun. Ostrich, which is a nice one. You know, ostriches are one of those animals that you struggle to believe is a real thing. You know, it's a massive bird. It looks weird. It's got disproportionately long neck and legs to the size of its torso, and it doesn't fly. Yeah. But they're good fun. It's good to see them. And then Corey Busted, short clawed lock, probably the special. I mentioned it earlier. In terms of being in the plains, looking out for short clawed lock, really, really good. In the rocky areas, you can look for things like mocking cliff chats, swallows nesting there, green pigeons. And around your dams, you'll get a lot of the more bird watery birds, storks and herons, geese, sandpipers. So you really do get a nice overview. Raptors are, you do get a good variety of species. You don't see them too often. I mean, you don't see a huge amount of them. I don't know if it's, Madikwe is quite flat and there's not really a huge amount of big trees there. And so I don't know if it's a lack of nesting opportunities or what it is, but still a good diversity and, Wahlbergs, brown snake eagle, black-chested, Varroes, tawny. And then what I did find is that you would find a lot of the smaller raptors there. So, yellow-billed kite, black-winged kite, gabon, pale-chanting goshawks. And then even like, that's probably the most popular scavenger bird there would be pied crows. So we don't see vultures too often, but a lot of pied crows. So pied crows are your indicator there of, possible carcasses or things like that. The vultures sometimes pop in, but it's more so if there's a bigger carcass that'll keep them around. So if you've got something like a giraffe or an elephant, then the vultures will probably be around. But more so the pied crows were the giveaways for that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. Because in December last year, we had this pied crow. He lived in a big tree a few meters from our house. Mm-hmm. And every day, he would bring something different to our bird bath. Often it was nice baby birds that he would smash against the bird bath and then eat. And then day he brought us a McDonald's hamburger. It was the most bizarre thing. You would walk to the bird bath and there would be something different in it every day. There was marbles. There's like a whole list that I could go on about this.
Oh, that's crow. Amazing. Yeah. I remember with the crows in Madikwe as well, they would, crows and hornbills at the lodge. Yeah. We would have, the snacks and people would have lunch there and stuff, and they would always be around and try and be as cute as possible and then steal stuff off of people's plates. And I remember the one day leaving the lodge or driving, I don't even know if it was our lodge, if I was passing another lodge, but there was a crow flying up above us. I was like, oh, it's got something in its mouth. And I got out the binos to see, okay, maybe it's got something. And I look and it's got a muffin in its mouth. It's flying a fucking muffin in its mouth. Okay, you're sorted for the rest of the day.
Yes. Yeah, no, those things, they eat anything and everything. But they're so intelligent as well. Creatures. I mean, yeah, sure. And going back to your point on ostriches, often I'll be driving somewhere and I'll see an ostrich and I'll be busy atlasing or something. And then I drive on further on, and then I realize, oh wait, an ostrich is a bird. I need to add this to my list. And,
it can be tricky to remember that, right?
It's like a, I don't know. I didn't think of them as birds, but they are.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's even like when you refer to them, it's still like it's a herd of ostrich. You know, it doesn't even fit in right with the collective, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think what makes me think of them as mammals more than birds is the fact they can't fly. I mean, I've always associated birds with flight.
For sure.
Obviously, ostriches not being able to fly. I think that plays on my brain a bit. And then when you look at their feet, they're like velociraptor claws.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah. They've no right to only have two toes like that. It's just...
Yeah. and during your time at Madikwe, what were some of the craziest sightings you had, whether it be birds, mammals, reptiles, is anything?
So probably, you know, starting with birds, probably two of the standout sightings that I had. First one was first time I'd ever seen a greater painted snipe. One of my colleagues said we were at an organized stop that the lodge had done for the guests. It was at the gin stop, so they were all enjoying themselves some gin, and we were chatting about what we'd seen on the drive so far. And he comes to me with this picture, and he's like, "Nick, you know what this is?" And he's now obviously gone with his phone, and he's zoomed in to the other side of the dam, but full specs with his camera. And he's taken a picture of a wader on the other side, and it's just completely blurry. It's just like bits of black and brown, and you know, you can see the blue of the water. And like, Billy, I've got no idea what that is. We're trying to look through the bird book, and nothing that looks like this blurry picture that you've taken. So we're like, sure, no idea. And we sort of left it, and the next day he comes back from the morning drive, and he's like, "Guys, I saw it again. still there." So I'm like, "Okay, no, we're going immediately." So we all, once everybody had dropped their guests off, we got into a cruiser and we headed over to the dam. And we go over to the side where he says he saw it, and we're looking, and we see, okay, there's a bird, and we look, and it's, okay, no, it's sandpiper. It's not what he was looking at. And we look over there, okay, wagtail, not what he was looking at. And it must have been 15 or 20 minutes that we'd been there. And eventually we're like, no, Billy, you're pulling our legs. There's nothing here. You're wasting our time. It's not working out. Let's just leave it. And we start the car, and we move a little bit forward. And that little bit of movement that we do, we see something walk behind a single log that's lying on the edge of the bank. And we stop quickly, and we have a look, and we wait, and out pops this little bird, and we all have a look, and we couldn't believe it. And we just start screaming, it's a snipe. And we're looking, and we're now all just confirming which one is, and yeah, greater painted snipe. And it was maybe there for 2 or 3 days, and then it left. But that moment where we all saw it, we're like, "Oh, Billy, you weren't talking absolute nonsense." It really was something unusual. It was amazing. It was the coolest thing, because we'd never seen it there, so it was a really nice one to add to the list. And seeing it walk around, and we sat there for another 20-30 minutes and watched it move up and down, and the guys that had cameras tried to blat some pictures, and it doesn't count unless you've got evidence. Guys can never go back at the lodge. You got to come with the data. So that was pretty cool. And then probably the second one for me was, I was driving in the south of the reserve, and in the south of the reserve, there's quite a big open plains area. So you've got the Duisburg Mountains that are all the way at the south of the reserve, and just before them, a little bit north of them, there's quite a big open plains area. And we were following a young male cheetah. He was busy walking through that long grass, and it was the most amazing area to follow him, because it was completely flat and completely open. And it's just this long grass, and we could follow him off road, so he could walk at a comfortable distance away from us, and we could just follow him around him and just watch him look around and do his thing, climb up onto termite mounds and walk through. And as he's walking, and it was starting to get a little bit darker. We decided we were going to follow him to the next road, and then we were going to carry on and let him do his thing. So it was starting to get a little bit, the sun was just about to set, and this bird starts to mob him. And I see it's quite a fairly big bird. I'm like, geez, trying to get at him, and it's like picking at him, and he's busy hissing at it. And I look with the binoculars, and like, oh, it's an owl. And then, try and follow it around a bit more. And eventually it perches on a tree just above me, and have a look. And it's a marsh owl. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a marsh owl. And it was just that moment of, you some days the bush just provides for you, you know, and you,
yes,
you think you're getting everything that you need just by following this cheetah. It's just you and this cheetah. That's, you know, what could be better? And, you know, suddenly that my guests had no, my guests, were from the UK, and they were like, okay, cool, it's an owl, that's cool. Yeah. And they were really excited. For me, I'm like, no, it's not just an owl, it's a marshal. I've never seen a marshal. It's amazing.
yeah, sure.
Yeah, just that we followed them, and then eventually they sort of kept going at each other, and we turned off on the next road, and they carried on. I don't know if they, maybe, I mean, we assume he was, I assume he was the one was mobbing the, that the owl was mobbing the cheetah. I mean, maybe they were buddies and they decided they were going to meet up at that point. And the two of them are now going to go find a nice spot to lie down and then chat about the day. So that was really special. Probably from a more mammal interaction point of view, one of the cooler sightings I had was we had information, or somebody had picked up that there was a zebra carcass close to our lodge. And so I think somebody had found it in the morning drive. And so we decided, okay, now we're going to go and have a look straight from the lodge, get the guests rallied up, and we're going to head straight there. It's maybe like a 8 to 10 minute drive, get to the spot. You know, expecting a bit of action. You know, we try and build it up before heading out on the drive. You know, what could we expect to see? What's, you know, try and get them in the mood for it. And yeah, we get there, and all there is the zebra carcass. There's nothing else. No, I didn't even think there was a bird in the area. It was just a zebra lying there, and nobody else in the area. So immediately, you know, you try not to, in your head, you're like, oh, darn, that's a bit disappointing. That would have been nice. But you try not to show that disappointment. So you're like, guys, you know what? We'll come back later. Let's go drive around a bit. We'll have a sundown. And then maybe when it's a bit darker, we can come back, you know, explaining that a lot of the predators are more active at night. And, you know, some, especially scavengers, hyenas, things like that might be coming out. So let's do that, and we'll come back later. So we carry on with our drive, have our sundown. It's now dark. We decide, okay, let's go have a look. We've waited long enough. It's now it's pitch dark. It's go time. We drive over there. Before I get there, I'm already shining the light, trying to build the suspense, you know, hoping that we pick up on something as we get closer. And we get there, and still just the zebra lying there. And it was a zebra there, and we see a bit of eyes, like, oh, cool, what's that? And it was a herd of zebra standing maybe 20 meters away from the zebra carcass. Not exactly what I had planned. a little bit of a flop, because now we've kind of centered our whole game drive around coming back, first coming to this, and then coming back later and hoping there's a bit of action, and both times there's been nothing. So a bit of a flop, but let's hang around and just see. You know, I didn't want to, part of me was like, you know, I don't want to leave, because we've put so much into this. Just please, let's just sit here for a bit and just absorb it. So we sat there for a while. And suddenly I heard the, you know, we put off the lights and everything. We just sat in the dark, and suddenly heard the zebras were sounding like they're a little bit agitated. They're starting to move around a bit more, and they're turning, and some of them are making a bit of sound. And get the light, I'm shining at them, and they all sort of turn and looking in a direction. Okay, and I scan the spotlight, and I see another pair of eyes. I'm like, ooh, hello, okay. And these eyes are a little bit lower to the ground, they're forward facing, and okay, guys, this is what we're looking for. Let's see what we've got. And out pops the spotted hyena. We're like, woo! Yes, this is what we were looking for. This is the moment. Spotty comes walking a little bit closer, and I decide to have a little scan around, see if there's anything else. And as I sort of flick the light around, this, you know, it was incredible how, and that was one of the things that always amazed me in the bush, is how quickly things can move up on you and how quietly they do so. So scanning this light around, there were just all these eyes around the vehicle. And Sean, there's just all these hyenas coming from different areas that weren't there 5 minutes ago, but suddenly have all started to pull in. So they start coming, but they're not getting super close, but they sort of maybe 10, 15 meters away. And some of them are looking at the zebra. Some of them are looking at the carcass. And they're sort of standing there. And as I keep shining around, the light catches a different shade. I'm like, oh, what's that? And suddenly this female lioness, or this female lion, pops up from the grass. And I mean, I assume she'd been lying there the whole time. She must have, we just couldn't spot her in the longer grass. But she stands up and starts walking towards the carcass. We're like, ooh, okay, here we go. This is exactly what we were looking for. So she walks towards the carcass and starts having feed, and these hyenas start to move around. They start calling, woo, woo, woo. And they start calling. And as these ones that are close to us are calling, we start hearing calling in the distance. And the calling is getting louder and louder, and it's just coming from all around us. And there's something about sound in the complete still of night, where you've got the cold air that's carrying it, and it just sounds so much more crisp around you. And you've got all of them calling, and they start to move around this lioness that's busy feeding on the zebra. And they're trying to harass her, and some of them are trying to bite behind her, and some of them are trying to steal pieces off the carcass. And we get to a point where they are, where there's a few of them, you know, five or six of them, that are pulling the one side of the carcass, and she's just holding on to the other side, and they're playing this tug of war. They're holding on to the other side, and they're pulling against each other, and others are running around them, and they're cackling, and they're snickering, and they have that little nervous laugh, and they're trying to intimidate her as much as possible, and she's just holding on to her end of the carcass. And this goes on for maybe 20, 30 minutes that we watch this interaction between her and this group of what eventually ended up being 16 hyenas that were 16 spotted hyenas were moving around her. And just the noise. And we were the only vehicle there, and it was completely dark, completely quiet. And it was just this interaction, which is incredible. And suddenly all the noise stops. Complete silence. And all the hyenas run away from the carcass, and the female lioness gets up, and she also moves off, starts walking away. I'm like, okay, that's a bit weird, but there's, you know, so something spooked them, guys. And you know, there's generally only one thing that they're all going to run away from like that, which means it must be some big boys coming around, because that's the only thing that's going to get 16 hyenas to run away in that fashion.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's two male lions, who'd obviously been attracted by all this commotion going on, burst into the scene, come trotting in and growling, snarling, chasing everyone away. And the two of them get stuck into the carcass, and we end up watching them feeding and completely dismantling that carcass in about 25 minutes or so that we sat with them while they were feeding. Eventually we decided, we've been there for quite a while, we'll leave it. What an incredible sighting. We start driving back to the lodge. And as we're driving back to the lodge, we just see these hyenas popping up every now and then with bits of meat in their mouth, busy walking back to their den or wherever they're going. But, you know, deciding that they're not going to go, and they're not going to stay and fight the good fight against the two big boys. They're going to go and do their own thing. And, you know, you're almost a kilometer or two away from the cocks, and you still have these hyenas walking away with bits that they've managed to pull away. So yeah, that was probably a big one for me. Just that interaction between the different species, the noises, the sounds, the way it made you feel. You know, that when you've got that call of the hyenas and the growling of the lions right next to you, it really goes through your body. That was incredible for me. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. That really does sound crazy. I mean, I've never been blessed with a sighting quite like that yet. In the future sometime. But and you've had quite a different journey into veterinary compared to most of the first years. So tell us a little bit about what caused the shift from guardian to veterinary, and how did you go about doing, you know, transitioning into that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, in school, when I was young, I knew I wanted to be involved with animals. So as a child, there were any sort of animal field was thrown about, you know, whether I want to be a vet or I want to be a zookeeper, you know, just whatever can get me involved with, the game ranger, whatever can get me involved with animals. And that, you know, that passion for animals yes. has always been it, you know. All my toys growing up were animals. All my, you know, when we watch TV, I never
really, same as me.
My friends always have a go at me because I'm terrible when it comes to movies. You know, they'll be like, you know, maybe watch that movie. Like, no, I haven't.
Yeah.
I haven't. It's just terrible. And, you know, when I watch TV, it was always sort of putting on Animal Planet or Nat Geo Wild and, you know, watching that and going on trips to nature reserves with family. And so it was always an interest in animals. When I was in high school, though, I was like, you know, I'm probably not going to end up being in the science or in the doctor field, medical field. So I'm not going to bother taking science. And so I didn't have science and left school and decided, okay, I want to, you know, what if we actually wanted to pursue something in the animal field? And I looked at some of my options and guiding was there and standing out. And I was like, geez, this looks like the most incredible life. You get to drive around, you get to look for these animals, you get to watch their behavior, and education was also a big thing for me. So, you know, you can get to teach people about them and try and promote conservation as well, which was a big one. So I went and studied to be a guide and ended up working at Madikwe Safari Lodge. And at my time at Madikwe Safari Lodge, I had a guest from California, Carl Palazzolo, who's a veterinarian himself. And he came for a 14-day safari, and it was just him, and he had an assistant with him. He was quite big into his photography. So it was just the two of them and myself on the vehicle for 14 days. He was quite specific in what he wanted to see. You know, he'd been on many safaris before, and so he didn't want to just drive around and get the usual shots that he already had. He wanted very specific action shots. And so there was a Goliath heron at a dam quite near to the lodge that had been there for a few days. And he decided that he wanted to sit at that waterhole and try and get pictures of that Goliath heron hunting. So we would sit there for hours on end, you know, 5-6 hours at a time at the waterhole, waiting for that Goliath heron to produce some action. There was Goliath heron, there was a fish eagle as well. And then whatever other game came, you know, we had lions that came to the waterhole, elephants, rhino. So he wanted to specifically wait at the waterholes and see what came to us. So there would be long periods of time where there wouldn't be much action going on, and so we'd get chatting. And in that chatting to him over those 2 weeks, I learned so much about the profession, you know, the veterinary profession, and what it entails. And, you know, he does a bit of wildlife work himself. And even during his time there, we did a bit of work with cheetah. So they put a GPS collar on, or they removed it as one of the two from a cheetah, and a bit of rhino work as also. There was, you know, getting that first bit of insight into it, and then hearing him just talk about it and, you know, he had such a passion for it, and instilled a passion for me. And I suddenly thought, you know, what if we could take this conservation thing, or this love for animals, to the next level, and try and push myself to a different level. So I decided to look into studying to be a vet, and soon realized that, you know, of course I needed to have science, and my maths mark would have needed to be a lot better. So That was the first obstacle. So I looked into how to fix that problem. You know, I decided I wanted to do this. So we were like, yeah, we just got to find solutions to these things. And then found out that you could upgrade these things. You know, it's not the end of the world. You can upgrade them. And so I decided, you know, I'm going to put everything into this. You know, if this is what it's going to be, then we're going to do it properly. So I could either do it through correspondence and continue working and then do it, you know, try and do this stuff in my spare time. But I decided, you know, I've got no idea. My maths was not great. I don't think I paid enough attention. And I didn't have science. And the two of them definitely go hand in hand. So I'm going to need to know what's cooking. And so I decided, you know, we're going to take this big leap of faith. And if we're going to commit, we're going to go full throttle. And so I left. I left Madikwe and moved to Cape Town, moved back with my parents and decided, okay, we're going to fully do this. So it was grade 10 to 12 maths and science that was done in a year. So it was intense. The workload was insane. And it was a lot. Yeah, it was a lot. I spent about 95% of my time sitting at a desk studying. But, you know, I think it, what helped was that the goal was very clear, you know, so when it, whenever it sucked, whenever it was boring, whenever I'd much rather be doing anything else, I was like, okay, but, you know, this is the end goal and there's only one way we're going to get there. So we completed that, got the results that I needed and then applied to veterinary. And while I was waiting, I then went back to Medico and continued to work there for a year while I waited to hear from the university. I had originally not been accepted, so they said I was accepted into zoology but not into veterinary. And then you could find out what place you came. So I messaged them and they're like, no, you were six places out for your category.
Sure.
Six place, and that makes it worse, you know.
You were that.
You're 100 out, you know. You okay? Well, then, you know, we miles off. It's not going to work. But I was like, six places. That's ridiculous. And so it was so close, but we were like, okay, no, that's great. You know, we can try and work with that. We'll push the zoology and try and move across. And I'd left Madikwe now ready to start zoology. And about 6 days before the orientation at Tux began, I got an email. And I just had that first line that said BVSC application. I'm like, okay, this is a bit weird. And open it and I just see that it is with pleasure. And as I read that part, the tears just started to pour down. Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, everything that had gone into all the decisions and pushing this and actively going after it had come down to that moment, and the tears just poured down. Now being at campus and being, you know, going on the tour, and we went to Honor Support and had a look around and just getting inside, it still feels so surreal. I'm still waiting for it to kick in. Because at the moment, I still sit in the lectures and I'm like, how am I even here? Every time they refer to us as the veterinary students, I'm like, what? Me as well? What?
Yeah.
So it was an incredible journey. But I'm, you know, and for some, it's a bit crazy to start now with 6 years, 7 years. But you know, I'm happy with the. With the timing of it, you know, I've said to you that I really commend people that can do it straight out of high school. You know, I don't think I would have been ready for it. I'm happy that I went and worked first and got a bit of experience and, you know, sort of got a bit of that, you know, post high school freedom, got a bit of that out the system, so that I could now fully focus on this and be ready for it. Very, very happy. And, you know, everything happens as it should, hey? Like, at the right time, these things happen. And so, ready for this next exciting adventure, hey?
It is very exciting. I mean, especially in orientation week when we sat down and the dean came and told us that you're in the Ivy League South African, you're in the equivalent of an Ivy League degree, and You are the best people in the university and whatever. That, yeah, that's when it really hit me, was, oh, you actually did this.
What?
Somehow.
What?
Yeah. After like 3 years of hard work, it eventually paid off.
Yeah, that you're actually there now.
Yeah,
hey?
It's great. Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. I still like can't believe it. Yeah.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah.
It was very surreal. What I loved about that chat from him,
yeah,
was that it started off like that, right? Like, yeah, you guys are cream of the crop. You're all
yeah,
very smart students. You're all this, and then he's like, but now you need to realize that all of you are smart and all of you are those kids. So that means that amongst each other, you're all the same. You're all average. So now you've got to start working. It's not good enough anymore. You've got to work, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I also thought that. And then he told us that we must take the pressure off now. And when I was studying for that MLB test the other day, it was like I was back in matric again. I'm thinking, I'm 100% for this thing. And then and then I realized, wait, no, you don't actually. You just need a boss now.
Yeah. That's
yeah.
That was the shift, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I think, and that's going to be a big shift for, I think, for a lot of people in our degree, is that, you know, high achievers expecting, you know, everything needs to be 80 plus.
Yeah.
Now it's like, you know, you don't not necessarily to sell yourself to that extent. You know, you can.
Yeah.
You've got to get through it, and then it'll be okay. You know.
Yeah. It's just incredible still. Yeah. Thanks 100%. So much for coming on the podcast, Nick. It was, you've been fantastic. I think you've been my best guest yet.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, most definitely. Awesome.
Thank you for reaching out to me. And yeah, it's been great.